solemn roll of funeral drums echoed throughout Washington, the nation, and the world as President John F. Kennedy was buried. You will hear highlights of the tragic story of a presidential assassination when this station presents 1963 in review. Promo cut number 2.
America, America, God shed his grace on thee and crowned thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea.
With these words, the 36th President of the United States concluded his first address to a joint session of Congress. It was a eulogy to the late President Kennedy and a promise to continue following the paths of the new frontier. You'll hear President Johnson's voice when this station presents 1963 in review. The little girl cried, "Oh, they can't do that," and a waitress sobbed, "My God, it isn't true." A cab driver mumbled, "I'm riding along, see, and I hear this on the radio, and I don't believe it. I don't believe it." Across the nation and across the world rolled the sickening echo of the assassin's bullets that took the life and presidency of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. These bullets turned into tragedy for all mankind the year 1963. This is Herbert Gordon. I'll be back with a review of the great stories of 1963 after this important announcement. It happened in Dallas, a city compounded of Texas legend and Texas pride, a big city, but raw at the edges from a land still close to the ornery longhorn cattle and tough cowpokes that once herded them. The president's visit had realistic political overtones. 1964 is an election year. He was off to mend his barbed wire fences in the Southwest. He spoke Friday morning, November 22nd, in Fort Worth. A speech largely devoted to the nation's strong defense posture. It was enthusiastically received, and at the end, a cheerfully applauding crowd gave him a Texas 10-gallon hat and urged him to put it on.
I'll put it on in the White House on Monday. If you'll come up there, you'll have a chance to see it there.
The president and his gracious first lady flew on to Dallas. The sun was bright, the weather Texas hot. Secret Service men swarmed everywhere. Faint but ominous overtones of danger had reached Washington earlier. But in going over Dallas with a microscope, they had overlooked one window, one man, one mail-order gun. The first bulletin of the assassination was filed by United Press International's famed White House correspondent, Merriman Smith. He was riding in the presidential motorcade. He screamed word of the shooting into a mobile telephone. And here is how he later described those tragic shots and what followed.
The first shot sounded, it could have been a very large firecracker or a small explosive, but the second one, you knew what had happened. Then came the third shot. They were beautifully paced. Bang, bang, bang. The man who did this was a pro, an accomplished pro. And then we saw the lead car, the president's car, suddenly take off, and we followed him and went over to the hospital. And
when you got to the hospital, what was it like there?
There were no interns, no litters, no nothing. The president was face down in the back of the car, and Jackie was bending over him as though she was whispering in his ear, and you could see on the right side of his jacket this growing stain, which he was bleeding at the time. And so at this point, I was pretty well convinced that he'd been awfully wounded, and I yelled over at one of the Secret Service men I knew, and I said, "How badly was he hit?" And he said, "Hell, he's dead."
Less than 2 hours after President Kennedy died in Parkland Hospital in the shocked city of Dallas, his body was placed aboard Air Force One and flown home. It lay in repose in the black-draped White House. Outside, the skies sobbed softly. And then a tide of mourners poured slowly into Washington town. Presidents, prime ministers, and kings, and people, just people, who had learned to love him in such a terribly short time. His body was taken to the great rotunda of the United States Capitol and lay in state. And Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield eulogized the young president. He told how Mrs. Kennedy, majestic in sorrow, had placed her wedding band in her husband's coffin.
There was the sound of laughter, and in a moment, it was no more. And so, she took a ring from her finger and placed it in his hands. There was a wit in a man neither young nor old, but a wit full of an old man's wisdom and a child's wisdom. And then, in a moment, it was no more. And so she took a ring from her finger and placed it in his hands. There was a man marked with the scars of his love of country, a body active with the surge of a life far from spent. And in a moment, it was no more.
The drums of death rolled across Pennsylvania Avenue. At St. Matthew's Cathedral, Richard Cardinal Cushing said Mass for this first Roman Catholic president.
Dominus vobiscum. Acquiesce, God in pace. Arce divisae de trenda, subsecum, cuisne, vestam, vet sacrificum, et arce tui, maes, aes, omnes, et vestit accessare, mihique, non, so qui, vestit, robes, et temes, anis, vet gavane, Christum Dominum Nostrum. Amen.
The black caisson was drawn by 6 white horses. A 7th was a guide. Behind the caisson pranced a black horse, its saddle empty. A pair of cavalry boots, pointed backwards, were in the stirrup. The march from St. Matthew's to Arlington National Cemetery was lined with tears. At Arlington, the ceremonies were poignant. A squad of riflemen fired the last volley. Taps rolled across a wooded hillside where, only a few weeks before, the president had called it such a beautiful spot, he could stay there forever. A saddened first lady lighted an everlasting flame at his grave. And there, we the world buried John Fitzgerald Kennedy, born May 29, 1917, died November 22, 1963, at 1 o'clock on a Texas afternoon. Minutes after President Kennedy was pronounced dead, Lyndon Baines Johnson took the oath of office. Mrs. Kennedy stood solemnly on his left as he swore to uphold the Constitution, and somehow, in the hectic moments of that brief ceremony aboard Air Force One, the historical event was recorded like this.
I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute
the office of President of the United States.
Reserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Immediately after taking the oath, Lyndon Johnson said simply, "Now, let's get airborne." And the 36th President of the United States was headed towards the White House. But in Dallas, the tragedy of violence and death continued. On stage, front and center, a conceited young ex-Marine, self-styled Marxist, Lee Oswald. On Sunday, as the funeral cortege for the President moved solemnly from the White House to the Capitol, in Dallas, Oswald was being moved from one jail to another. In the confusion of the transfer, cameras ground, spectators, police, and reporters looked on, and a balding 50-ish Dallas nightclub operator, Jack Ruby, elbowed his way towards the suspected assassin.
And there he comes, Lee Oswald, the accused assassin, Captain Wilkes leading the way, being escorted by police officers and sheriffs. Shot has rung out. And Lee Oswald falls. Lee Oswald has fallen. A shot has rung out here. A struggle is being in place. A shot has rung out. And ladies and gentlemen, Lee Oswald has just been shot.
Oswald died in the same hospital at almost the same hour that President Kennedy had died 2 days earlier. Later, the FBI, after an intensive study of the president's assassination, said Oswald presumably was the killer and was working alone. But there were more great stories in 1963, and I'll be back with those after this important announcement. ...1963 was a year that began with a plea from President Kennedy for bold action to resolve the problems facing this nation.
It is of great importance for the years ahead that we act boldly now. If we are to assure more jobs for our ever-growing labor force, if we are to achieve higher standards of living for our people, and if we are to continue to provide the least required of us in the free world community.
If any group of U.S. citizens took the bid to act boldly seriously, it was America's Negroes. For them, 1963 held out the hope of a year of great change. New legislation appeared possible on the horizon for civil rights. Old walls of prejudice were crumbling, but it wasn't an easy year or an easy fight. James Forman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee looked pragmatically at the dangers he faced in his work in the South.
I think that we've all been marked to death. I mean, in these areas where we work, they are predominantly black belt areas where the Negroes have a majority of the voting strength if they were allowed to vote. And I think that the people who control the political processes in these counties do not want to see us register, do not want us there to try to register vote, and so they do put price tags on our head.
as Americans struggled both with and against fellow Americans on the battlefield of civil rights, the Negro found comfort in old songs with new words in the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham in May, the same church where the blood of children was to be spilled in violence a few months later. They sang together.
Walking up the freedom land.
Two Negroes, James Hood and Vivian Malone, sought to crack Alabama's rigid wall against Negroes in white universities. Governor Wallace warned he'd never permit Negroes to enter the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa.
As governor, I am the highest constitutional officer of the state of Alabama. I embody the sovereignty of this state, and I will be present to bar the entrance of any Negro who attempts to enroll at the University of Alabama. This is legal resistance and legal defiance.
But the great state of Alabama found its defiance overwhelmed by the greater power of the Federal Union. Tuscaloosa opened its doors to two Negroes. And yet, perhaps, two incidents above all symbolize the Negro's drive for the improvement of his position in U.S. life in 1963. In Little Greenwood, Mississippi, Mrs. Mary Diggs, colored, for the first time in her life, registered to vote.
I'm just too happy over what I did today. Never had the opportunities before in my life. And I really enjoyed it because I had to stand up so long till it looked like my back was broke and I couldn't get along after I got over with it. But yet still, I'm feeling better now. I'm telling you the truth. At the courthouse, I hope I don't ever have to go back there for anything else soon until I get rested up over what I have did. You know, I was just talked to just like I had been a dog.
But in Washington, on a hot and smothering day, almost 200,000 Negroes and whites, in the greatest mass demonstration of its kind in the history of the nation, assembled for a massive peace march. Joan Baez sang a song that has become the banner of the integration movement. Restive but silent thousands moved towards the brooding statue of Abraham Lincoln, and there the peace demonstration concluded with this pledge.
I pledge my heart and my mind and my body unequivocally and without regard to personal sacrifice to the achievement of social peace through social justice.
How do you pledge? I so pledge.
Not all whites were impressed with the struggle of the Negro for equality. In Birmingham, symbol of Southern troubles, when a school was integrated, an 18-year-old student said,
a lot of people say not going back until they leave. Well, I tell you, I'm not going back till they leave. I don't want to go to school with them. Yeah, I'm going to stay away until they put them out. I think it really ought to be up to the student because their parents don't have to go to school with them. And I think if we keep this up long enough, we can run them away.
Of all the awesome weapons of destruction devised by man, none is yet so terrifying as the secret nuclear submarine. In April, the United States became painfully aware that for all its frightening power, a killer nuclear sub is still subject to the defects of anything built by man. The USS Thresher disappeared during an underwater test. In Washington, a saddened George Anderson, Chief of Naval Operations, reported,
very reluctantly, I have come to the conclusion that the USS Thresher, which we held for a time as missing, has indeed been lost.
But if the nation was having troubles beneath the seas, In the vastness of space, the rocket program was in full vigor. L. Gordon Cooper, astronaut, made the longest U.S. flight to date in a space capsule, more than 22 orbits of the world. A signal light warned of trouble before re-entry. Cooper brought down his ship manually with the aid of a fellow astronaut, John Glenn.
Okay, the next 10-second count will be a countdown to your manual intro, over.
A few weeks later, the Russians proved they were still ahead of the United States in the race for space. Two astronauts were placed in almost identical orbits by a Soviet scientist. One was a woman, Valentina Tereshkova, and from outer space, she talked to the world. The first half of 1963 ended on a note of sadness both for the Roman Catholic Church and millions who loved him. Pope John, warm, inspiring, and filled with the good humor of natural fellowship, died.
This is William Sunderland of United Press International in Rome. Here is the voice of the Pontiff speaking in Latin. It was the last public speech made before his illness. It was broadcast to pilgrims in Poland on Sunday, May 26th, while the Pontiff lay seriously ill. It had been recorded a few days before. He is speaking of the two major encyclicals issued during his reign, Mater et Magistra and Pacem in Terris.
Within a matter of days, the church had elected a new pope. He chose the name Paul, and he promised to continue the ecumenical council which had been convoked by Pope John. After his coronation, Pope Paul offered his first benediction in these words.
Dominus vobis cum,
and I'll be back with those after this important message. In 1963, the Cold War began to thaw noticeably. In mid-year, the United States and the Russians installed a so-called hotline, a private teletype linking the Kremlin and the White House directly. Presidential News Secretary Pierre Salinger described it in these terms.
Today in Geneva, the representatives of the governments of the United States and the USSR at the 18-nation disarmament conference signed an agreement which will establish a direct communications link between their respective capitals. This age of fast-moving events requires quick, dependable communications for use in time of emergency. By their signatures today, therefore, both governments have taken a first step to help reduce the risk of war occurring by accident or miscalculation.
In the fall, there were two major developments in U.S.-Soviet relations. The United States and the Soviet Union, joined by virtually every nation except Red China, signed an agreement to restrict nuclear tests in outer space, the atmosphere, or the ocean's depths.
Soberly and unremittingly, this nation, but never this nation alone, has sought the doorway to effective disarmament and to a world where peace is secure. Today we have a beginning, and it is right for us to acknowledge all whose work across the years have helped to make this beginning possible.
Shortly afterwards, the United States announced it would attempt to work out an agreement with Russia for a multi-million-dollar wheat sale, and the president proposed a joint moonshot. At year's end, the Soviet had not yet accepted. Meanwhile, this was a year of great changes in great governments. In Canada, Prime Minister John Diefenbaker was replaced by Lester Pearson. In Germany, Chancellor Adenauer retired. That story from Wellington Long in Bonn.
Adenauer's voice was as strong as it had ever been at the peak of his powers. And though he claimed this was an emotion-filled day for him, he gave no outward sign of it. He was stepping down after 14 years at the head of the West German government. But though he is only 3 months short of his 88th birthday, he was still full of fight. I was sitting right above the opposition Social Democrats and could see most of them squirming uneasily at Adenauer's sallies. And he warned the socialists he would continue to speak up whenever they challenge him.
Ich werde zuhören. Ich hoffe wenig zu sprechen.
England, that was a chapter all by itself. There was a girl named Christine Keeler, a war secretary, John Profumo, a Soviet military attaché, and a society osteopath, Stephen Ward. And when the scandal had dripped the last bit of ink from titillating headlines, a society doctor had committed suicide. A war secretary had resigned in disgrace. Christine was catapulted from common call girl to international notoriety. Prime Minister Macmillan had hung on to reins of government through scandal, but illness later forced his resignation. Lord Hume, Macmillan's successor, read Macmillan's retirement announcement at a party convention in Blackpool.
If the operation which I am to undergo tomorrow proves successful, it is clear that I will need a considerable period of convalescence. I would not be able to face all that is involved in a prolonged electoral campaign. Nor could I hope to fulfill the tasks of Prime Minister for any extended period, and I have so informed the Queen.
In South Vietnam, President Ngo Dinh Diem died violently as revolution swept his war-torn land. The generals took over. In the United States, Madame Nu was visiting in Los Angeles, the wife of the powerful brother of the President Ngo Dinh Nu. She was asked if the United States had played any role in the overthrow of the regime.
Definitely, in Vietnam, it is this. No coup can be can erupt without at least American incitement or American backing.
In his first address to the joint session of Congress, President Johnson paid tribute to his fallen predecessor and concluded with these words.
And on this Thanksgiving Eve, as we gather together to ask the Lord's blessing and give him our thanks, let us unite in those familiar and cherished words, America, America, God shed his grace on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea.
It was a year that was great in many ways. It was a year of natural disasters, and it was a year of tumult and turmoil. A baby was born, lived briefly, and died. He was Patrick Kennedy. In Aberdeen, South Dakota, America's first quintuplets were born. 1963 was quite a year. This is Herbert Gordon speaking for United Press International. And as the year ended, there was this last dramatic development.